Welcome back. This is Module 2. This is Microsoft Virtual Academy. We're talking today about XAML tooling, especially Blend, but we're looking right now at what the XAML tools are for Visual Studio. A lot of new things in Visual Studio 2013. Module 1, we talked about some of the core editing experience and a little bit of the coding experience inside C Sharp. We started talking about some of the tools in the tool, or some of the controls in the toolbox. We didn't get to the end. I want to make sure we at least cover some of those fun ones, then we'll go through this as well. So let's just look at where we are headed, though. The first thing we'll talk about in this module are the built-in templates. There's a whole bunch of templates for new projects, and, well, not a whole bunch. That makes it sound like there's a lot. There's one.
Five.
And there are also new templates for pages as well. We want to go through those and just make sure we have a grasp around each of them. We'll talk about some of the basics around migration if you have an 8.0 app. Of course, there's a lot of documentation already out there about that. We'll go through the devices panel. That's where we started in the last module. And then some of the advanced features that really are geared towards making your XAML app awesome, and maybe how you can leverage those. And we'll just demo those at a high level as well. But before we do anything, Uni, I want to remind everybody that the code that you and I are doing here, I mean, right now we're just dragging goofy things on, so that's not it. But the code that we're using as samples, sample code, is all available to them at xaml.codeplex.com. Mm-hmm. So it's XAML, xaml.codeplex.com. And as we make changes through the rest of the modules, we'll be checking those in so you can get those as well. But they're already there as well, some of the completed ones that we'll be using as references if anything in our demo goes wrong.
Absolutely.
And all right, so let me open up Visual Studio really quick. And I'll have here, let me add it. I'll just add it to this one, and we'll remove it in just a second. Because I want to show a few of the controls that we didn't have time to show in the last piece. So here's my toolbox. And in Windows 8.1, some of that have come in are really cool. And there are the flyouts. And we'll demo the flyouts in Module 5, where we will use those inside an app. But a flyout is basically just that thing that pops up. You know, sometimes you have a button in the command bar. It's just a tiny little button. And it's too small for you to really be able to use. You want to show 1, 2, 3 different sub-items. How do you show those? You show it with a flyout. And so we have flyouts that attach to the button. You could have a menu flyout, or you could have just a general flyout where you put anything that you want in there. But what I want to show is the time picker. So we have a time picker, and we have a date picker. Now, the reason we're showing this is not because these are revolutionary, but because they're new in Windows 8.1, and this is something that XAML developers were always needing to build on their own in 8.0. And so we have both a time picker and a date picker, and they're fully bindable, so you can use all of the patterns that you want to, and it solves all the problems. And of course, we know that as you go from one localized set to another, you know, not every country puts the day second like we do. Sometimes it's in a different order. This handles that by reading the local information on the current user and reordering it the way it needs to be for them. The other one that we didn't get a chance to show was the what was the other one? Oh, in the text box. So here's a text box. We've always had text box. It's pretty simple, we know. But what's great about it is it's pretty much 100% the case that any developer who uses a text box has to add it to a stack panel that includes a text block, because they want to add some sort of text that I want you to type your first name, but now I need to have some sort of header on it so that you know that that's the first name. And so now we have header built into the text box. So if I go to the property of the text box over here, I can go down to, I'll just search for it real quick. Here's the header, and I can say this is the first name. What's great about this is if developers use this header rather than their own, from app to app to app, users are going to have a very repetitive, familiar experience as they see, forms over data. Another neat thing is you can see it says text box. That's because that's the default data in the text property right now. So I'll go down to text. I'll see that. I can clear it so it doesn't have, goofy data. But I still might want to prompt them, you know, what do they mean by first name? Does that include my title, doctor, or something like that? So now I can go into the placeholder text, which is right here below it. And I can say this is, for Dr. Smith, or that's probably the worst first name ever. But it allows me to have this watermark that goes away when the user goes in and gives it focus, but it gives them a little bit more guidance so you don't have to worry about pop-ups or anything to help the user put the correct data in. So anyway, these are some of the subtle things, but they're really powerful as well as far as removing complexity around your XAML and using some of these built-in features. There we are. Let's go to the new project types and kind of walk through those.
Absolutely. So if you don't mind switching to my monitor. All right. So I'm going to take you through what I'd call like the anatomy of a simple project template. So we can sort of walk through the pieces that sort of are essential to sort of getting this basic app up and running. But before we go that, I wanted to sort of walk you through the new project dialog in Visual Studio. If you are like, and by the way, like you can create projects in Blend as well. I'm just using Visual Studio because I'm going to show you some code to see how these things actually work. Mm-hmm. You have templates that are consistent across Visual Basic, Visual C++, and Visual C# as well. In this case, I'm going to use C# because that's the language I'm most comfortable with. We have added one new template, which is the hub app for doing the hub pattern, as is evident in the preview on the right-hand side here.
Perfect. So if a developer saw you last module show the hub, and they're like, nice, I like it. Now how would I ever implement it? They could start here.
Yeah, and we're going to take a look at that in a second. But most developers that I actually know of, once they know the basics of the platform and patterns and things like that, they prefer to start from scratch and add content as they see appropriate. So that's perfectly fine as well. For that, we have the blank app, as well as a couple other templates like the grid and split.
We had the grid before and the split before. What's new here is hub.
Hub.
So you're saying that I could use grid, hub, and split as a learning experience.
That's right. So in addition to these templates, which are sort of your app templates, we also have class library, so you can share code across multiple apps, or even within the same app, you can refactor your code to be reusable across apps.
Across C# apps.
Across C# apps, and in if you were to create a Windows runtime component, you could reuse that across C# and,
So that's the class library across all the languages.
That's correct. Yeah, Windows runtime, as you know, allows the developer to write code that runs across languages in some ways, like by exposing their types as WinRT types. So you could do that as well, but generally people sort of tend to stick to the language that they write in.
Yeah.
So it's primarily for refactoring your app. So, that
so if I'm writing a library of controls or code that's for me, and I always write in the same language, then a class libraries
is probably perfectly fine. And then portable class libraries is this concept for sharing code across multiple XAML platforms. So if you wanted to share code, if you're a developer writing a WPF app and want to share significant assets in terms of your backend or something like that with your Windows Store app, you'd consider using a portable class library. So all these templates are there. In addition, there are a couple of test templates as well to allow you to test your app. But let's go ahead and create a hub app and take a look at what's really in this particular template. Before we even do anything, let's go ahead and run it to see how it looks like.
Yeah, great idea. That's pretty cool. Right out of the box,
You do nothing, create a new project, run it. You have your basic hub pattern. Let me just get rid of this thing. You have your basic app pattern up and running. Mm. You click on a particular section. You can add more data about that particular item that you just clicked on. Mm-hmm. If the general Windows pattern requires you to sort of put this chevron up here over the section, if your section has more data that goes behind it. So I can click on a section, I can see more data about that particular section. So I have like a hero item, and then I have like other items that sort of display more information about that particular section as well. So this is sort of your...
That little sideways chevron is built right in as a feature of the hub control.
That's correct. You don't need to do anything there. It's all built in, so that's all good.
Pretty cool.
So that's your basic hub app. Like it's pretty functional out of the box. Go ahead and start adding some content.
You can submit it to the store.
Absolutely. Like it passes all validations and things like that. We'll talk about that in a little bit as well. But let's take a quick look at what makes the hub app. So really this app, if I was to sort of break it down for you, consists of three different pages. There is the home page, the hub page that contains all of the hero images and sections and things like that. Let's go ahead and open it. So that's sort of your starting page for your app. Let me just zoom out a little bit so you can see everything. So that's your hub page. You select different sections, and you can see like different sections over there, all of them showing some data at design time. So you can work against that data. The item page is for a particular item that you clicked on. So there's some navigation. There's some navigation that gets triggered when you click on a particular item that takes you to the particular page that shows more details about the item, and you can add more content to this page. And then there is the section page, which when you click on a particular hub section that has more items, we take you to the page. So it's a three-page application. There's some navigation hooked up for you. So let's see how that really works. App.xaml is sort of your application object, the object that always exists when your app is running, and it controls the entry point into your app. It controls things like state that you can persist across multiple pages in your app and things like that. let's go ahead and open app.xaml.cs. The thing to note here is it's a simple event-driven model. There's a constructor that gets run. The constructor hooks up some event handlers so that your app can respond to Windows events, like when your app gets suspended and things like that. There is the on-launched handler that gets called when your app is ready to do something. And in the on-launched handler, along with a whole bunch of other things that we won't get into today, you basically trigger the navigation to the home page of your app.
Okay, so that bottom line is the initial location that we go to.
That's correct. And that's really the type of the hub page over here. So if I open up the hub page and go to the root, there is an X:: class here. That's the name that you're kind of using to trigger navigation to the particular page to start with. So that's your app.xaml.cs. It does a whole bunch of other things, like hooking up event handlers. When your app sort of crashes, you want to do error handling and report the error to the user, you know, or error conditions and things like that. You can handle all of that in your app.xaml.cs.
Nice.
Your app.xaml is also the place where you would add resources, like we discussed in the earlier section, that are global to the app. If you wanted to use a brush across multiple pages, this would be one particular location where you could put the brush and still use it across.
So we're really talking about scope. You put it here, and it's scoped to
everything.
That's correct.
And the most common pattern that we see people use is they kind of create resource dictionaries for all their brushes and colors and fonts and styles, and they link into application resources, the most common ones.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we totally recommend that you do not link in everything into your application. You just link in things that you need, just to not make sure that your app starts up fast. But it's perfectly valid to sort of link in everything into app.xaml if you're just talking like a small set of resources.
All your text blocks look the same.
Exactly.
Like that. Yeah.
Okay.
Kind of reminds me of a CSS file
right.
in a lot of ways.
So what we have seen so far is we have seen the application object that triggers navigation to the hub page. Mm-hmm. But there are a couple other important parts to this app as well. That's located in the common folder. The common folder contains, I would say, like three important things that are really relevant to the XAML developer. There is Navigation Helper, which is sort of a service that we provide you to allow you to sort of save your state and load your state back up again when the user is sort of navigating across pages. Similarly, you really want your apps to be keyboard accessible, right? So you want the user to press the right key and trigger to the next page and the previous page and so on and so forth, the back
right.
key hookup. This particular helper class library provides a bunch of useful functionality that allows you to do these sort of things in your app.
Now, this is a type of helper class I could easily pull out of this project, put it into my project, and start using.
Oh, absolutely.
We're not saying a developer can't write this from scratch as well. There's nothing in here that's magic that we've
right.
done. We just
we want to make sure that the apps that we build out of the box on Visual Studio comply with the Windows guidelines all the way through and through, including accessibility. As well as, as you're aware, if your app is consuming a lot of resources, your Windows might kill your app if the user is not actively interacting with the app. It's recommended that when such a thing happens and when the user decides to go back to their app to restart their work, we don't put them back into the home page of the app, and we instead leave them in the page that the user sort of left off. So such functionality can be easily hooked up by using these helper class libraries. So if I was to go back to hubpage.xaml, and take a look at the code behind, you will see that we are creating an instance of the navigation helper over here in the constructor, and we are sort of passing in a reference to the page. That's all you need to do, and everything else is then taken care of for you. We also could optionally hook into the load state. So if your app was expecting some state to get dehydrated, when the app resumes, that's where you would sort of do your actions, and we would call you back with the data that you want to rehydrate your app with.
Okay, so this goes back to process lifecycle. If my app is about to be suspended, I might want to save it off so that when the user comes back, it's all there again. This is the load state. There's an equivalent save state as well.
That's correct. And all of these are actually functionality that is provided by this class over here, which is called Suspension Manager. If you built an app in Windows 8, this is an artifact that you're already familiar with. This is an artifact that allows you to do things like saving and restoring your data. So think about it this way. The page calls into the navigation helper, which in turn calls into Suspension Manager to do some fork for it. So that's the way
the page helper is an instantiated helper, and the Suspension Manager is a static helper.
That's correct. And the third most important component of this particular template is your data source, right? In this case, we have some data, which is just a simple hierarchy of classes. So there's sample data.
It is gray boxes, after all.
Exactly. It's
pretty
simple. Much, yeah. There is sample. There is a what a pseudo view model here, a group and an item. So the pseudo view model contains a set of groups, and the set of groups contains a set of items. All we do is we read this JSON file when the app is running. We hydrate our view model, and then we sort of like visualize that in your app, so to speak. Okay. Right. So that's sort of like your basics of how you sort of load data. Now, in a real world scenario, you would not load any data when the app is launched. You would sort of asynchronously get the data. That's all baked into the sample data source. You can use this as a pattern for building your view models if you want. So if I go to this class over here, get sample data async, as you know, we have already built it to be async, even though we could do this synchronously and nobody would notice a thing. We are getting data asynchronously just as a best practice. So when a call is made to get items async, we have an async function that actually reads the data, the JSON file. So the UI thread never blocks, right, as the data is getting fetched. And this becomes more and more relevant in a services world where you're actually getting data from a service. So that's the way you would populate the data. Just rest of it is just simple JSON parsing and population of your data structures.
Sample data, this is what it does at runtime. That's not how it actually gets the code that you see at design time. We'll talk about design time data and sample data soon, but what you were showing was a runtime solution.
That's correct. And when we go into the data section, we will actually show you some tips and tricks that you can use to better visualize your objects at design time, so you can actually see some data here as well. So just to sort of touch on this template before we wrap up this section, if you take a look at the hub section over here, and I scroll a little bit to the right, you see this annotation in here called d:datacontext, which is what we call design time data context. We'll touch this topic when we talk about the data section, when we go into the data section. But nonetheless, this d:datacontext is primarily useful for specifying your data context at design time, so you can see some objects and work against them. So if you want to do some styling, and your data is coming from some service, you may not have access to the data when your code is running inside Visual Studio.
Yeah.
We have built-in constructs that allow you to visualize objects at design time, and only at design time.
So there's no impact. Get out of the way at runtime.
Exactly. There's no impact to your running app. You're sort of populating, in this case, some sample data. In this case, it so happens that the same JSON file is used at design time and runtime, but these could be completely different JSON files that's fetching different data, in some cases from a service.
Yeah. I guess it's possible that you might be fetching them both, but it's not that's an edge.
Pretty much. And then the rest of it is simple hookup. So if you will notice that there is, if you go to in hubpage.xaml.cs, there is event handler for hooking up the click. So when the user clicks on a hub section header, so let's go take a quick look at that. Here's the section header that has, like, you can see there is a chevron here. We have hooked up the click event handler somewhere over here. That sort of like allows the user to click right over here, click on an item or a header, and then respond to that particular click and do some things, right? So in this case, I'm hooking up to the item click event. If I go to my hubpage.xaml.cs, there's my item click event. When the click happens, I'm navigating to a page.
So these templates are really, they're excellent templates and starting points for developers who have no idea where they're going, right? I mean, you may already, if you, for example, had, Uni's MVVM platform, whatever it was, that's the one that you prefer. Well, you might actually start with blank and go from there. But if you're really looking for guidance and some best practices, these templates are set up particularly for that.
That's correct.
And honestly, there are some things that you might actually want to pull over anyway. This navigation helper, when you pull that over, it gives you more accessibility. And there's also a relay command, which is an MVVM concept, so you can handle click events without having to handle click events.
Yeah.
And then you also have that suspension manager, which, if you wrote your own suspension manager, it's going to look almost exactly like this one as well. So those three files alone are pretty worthy of being brought into any application.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at this template, it's actually doing a lot of heavy lifting that you would commonly do in your app. So you certainly can use this as a starting point and then just hook up, replace the sample data source object with my data source object that's fetching data from some service. And then you have your basic hub app with real data up and running in no time.
Perfect. Now, let's take a concept just for a moment. Let's pretend I've got my application written for 8.0, and I just want to think at a high level. What am I thinking about as far as migration? First, is it worth it going from 8.0 to 8.1?
Absolutely. I think it makes total sense. I mean, as you know, 8.1 is a free upgrade. Mm-hmm. you probably want to think about this from a consumer angle first. Yeah. You know, you have significant advances that Windows 8.1 brings to the table. So as the consumer, you're sort of incentivized to use Windows 8.1.
Yeah.
And then as a developer, you have a double incentive. You have a platform that's more performant, yep. that has more capabilities, the tools are better, and so on and so forth. So it brings, it's really a compelling use case that sort of, you know, drives you to sort of use 8.1 features over time, yeah. you know?
I mean, when you look at the, like, side by side, if you think about the new features in 8.1, they're pretty great, but if you look at performance improvements in 8.1, it might even outweigh all the new
yeah,
API features.
Absolutely. I mean, if all you did was take your app, did no changes to it, just rebuilt it as 8.1,
yeah.
your app is like 10% faster. Because we now sort of have this new feature where we compile your XAML into XBF and things
yeah,
like that.
Yeah.
So you get performance out of the gate. Your controls are faster. Everything is just faster by just doing nothing, literally recompiling.
If I'm a store developer and I'm worried, I'm like, well, you know, all my users may not be on 8.1 yet. You can deploy them both.
Oh, absolutely. The store is sort of capable of sort of, you know, maintaining two versions of your app and then serving the right app to the right audience. So there is absolutely, yeah. you know, the use case there as well. Like I said, just recompiling gets your performance, but now you start sort of like taking advantage of some of the features as well. So, for
yeah.
example, the grid view in Windows 8.1 is designed to sort of handle large data sets and at the same time maintain great frame rates as the user is fastly panning through data.
Yeah.
Right. So these kinds of things you can start taking advantage of by doing some little bit of extra work on top of your existing app. So we've seen examples where by just making like maybe like 2 hours of investments in your app gets like 100% faster.
Wow.
So it really comes down to, I guess, how bad your app was written to start with,
yeah.
and in some cases, the platform improvements as well. So
sure.
put together, I think there's a lot of value in sort of migrating to
8.1. Well, you know, I mean, we always show demos with 15 items in the grid. You mm-hmm. know, I mean, it's a small number. You know, you think about a line of business application or just Netflix. You know, it's just applications with a lot of data where 15 items, they have 15,000 items, 150,000. I mean, you know, they've got so many that they are scrolling through. And so if those were issues for you, that is another...
Absolutely. I mean, you have to be smart as a developer as to the choices you make.
Yeah.
Like, is it the use case that the user is going to go through 15,000 items, or is it the
Never.
Use case that the user is going to go through 300 items? I think it's
yeah.
more likely that you want to sort of add some level of virtualization where you don't sort of even load that data.
Yeah.
But at the same time, there is absolutely a use case where you want to show hundreds of items and the user is sort of quickly navigating through them. For that particular use case, actually, we made a lot of improvements in the platform to make it easy for you to pan through your data sets.
Sure. Well, in the previous module, we kind of hinted at the device panel. It's probably one of the most powerful things that we have. Let's open it up. Let's look at it in Blend, even.
Absolutely.
And see what the device panel offers. I'll talk just for a second about the windowing in 8.1. So
sure.
in 8.0, we had windowing where your app had three possible states. It could either be portrait, landscape, full, or it could be snap, this 320-pixel-wide, very narrow area. Now, in Windows 8.0, we've changed that. So
8.1.
In Windows 8.1, thank you. We've changed that so that your application has a variable size. The user can kind of decide how wide your app goes, all the way down to 500 pixels. And then that 500 pixels is the minimum that any application has to support. You can still opt in to be a 320 wide pixel app if that's important to you. That's absolutely, it fits certain scenarios. Of course, you can still be portrait as well. So that all that variability, I still want to be able to visualize some of that inside Visual Studio or inside Blend. This is where the device panel really shines.
Yeah. So before we switch to device panel, I wanted to show you can right-click on a XAML page, and you can sort of say open in Blend, and we will sort of load Blend with
nice.
The right solution loaded, the project loaded, and the XAML file open
so
as well.
So Blend is not a page viewer. It opens the entire solution.
Yeah. So Blend's a, just so folks who don't know about Blend, Blend's a design-focused tool.
Mm-hmm.
It's a part of Visual Studio. You get Visual Studio, you do get Blend.
Yep.
It's not an optional install. You have the same set of XAML platforms supported in Blend as in Visual Studio. So Visual Studio has support for WPF and Silverlight and Windows Phone. Blend also has the same platforms depending upon the SKU of Visual Studio that you have.
Okay.
And Blend offers a lot more richer functionality for customizing your app. Since we were talking about the device panel, let's just focus on that for a second and look at some of the features that the device panel exposes to you, the XAML developer, to optimize your app for Windows.
Okay.
So let's go through all of these settings, and I'll sort of call out some of these settings when they are distinct between Windows 8 and Windows 8.1. Okay. So like we discussed in the last module, the display setting is used to simulate your app at different DPI settings. It's now, of course, if you're familiar with XAML, you pretty much get dynamic layout of the box, use a grid, and then everything sort of automatically stretches. Everything is all good, right? But there is another thing that you should be really careful about when you're designing a Windows 8.1 app, or a Windows app in general, or Windows Store app. Your app is designed to run all the way from, like, you know, crappy 96 display DPIs by modern standards,
yeah,
to displays that go as much as like 400 DPI. Like, that's going to be pretty common going forward, right? So not only do we want to sort of make sure that your layout sort of scales correctly and your app resizes correctly, you also want to make sure that you specify assets. When I say assets, I really mean scalar assets, images and things like that,
yeah,
at different scale factors. Windows has a mechanism built in that allows you to sort of see your images at different scale factors. Mm. And you want to make sure that your app already has asset classes that it specifies. There are 4 or 5 classes you can specify. You can specify like 100% scale, 140, 180, and things like that.
So don't ship just poor quality images that look great on a small device.
Yeah.
Ship also really nice images as well. But don't just ship the nice ones either, because then you're giving up memory for nothing on
devices
that can't see.
And this is where classic design comes in, right? Like, you often, Windows will do the right thing of scale. Let's say you were to ship the highest quality asset every single case.
Yeah.
Windows does the right thing of scaling the asset down as required. Mm. But as a designer, you may not always want that. Like, yeah, you want to sort of have absolute control of your pixels in a lot of cases. And that's the place where you want to sort of, like, you know, specify multiple asset classes and things like that.
So that dropdown showed all kinds of different physical sizes, as well as the resolution size as well. So you can go through both to see the scaling of assets, as well as what happens when I have this grid and I'm on a 27-inch device.
That's correct. The default project template does not have, just has like the 100% assets. Mm-hmm. But if you had like assets that were corresponding to one of these other form factors here, we would show that on the design surface as you make tweaks as well.
Nice.
So you can preview not only for your scale, your layout scaling, you can also preview different classes of assets as well.
Very nice.
At different scale factors. Then, of course, there is the orientation, which allows you to preview your app. And of course, the hub app does not show very well unless I select a different section. So probably not the right pattern to use out of the box in this particular case. But you can sort of preview your app as it looks like.
But it is great, because sometimes I think developers think, okay, now I've got to write 5 different versions of my app to handle every orientation. Now I can come into the device panel here and switch it around and say, hey, some of these controls naturally kind of morph and handle this. And kind of, it's a responsive design that these controls already have built in. It allows you to see it right here, even if you don't have a device that you can turn and see it as portrait.
Yeah, mode. I mean, you get responsive design by default, but at the same time, you could also use the states panel to control precisely how your controls and appear in which order and things like that. So both of those are viable choices as well. You can just leave it up to the platform to do the right thing in the majority of the cases, or precisely control what controls appear in which layout as you want to.
Got it.
Okay, so moving on. The edge setting of the device panel allows you to preview,
That's interesting.
Yeah, let me auto-hide the app bar.
Hold space. Isn't that
the there we go.
Too?
Okay, yeah. Great. See, it's like...
Oh, no, look, yeah.
There we go. So let me just zoom in a little bit. The edge setting in device panel allows you to preview your app at different, modes where
they may have dragged
exactly.
it to, sure.
So in this case, you want to see your app as to how it looks like when the user has some other app docked on the right-hand side.
Yeah.
And your app is sort of like getting the remainder of the space. Now, one good thing is you can also, the app on the right-hand side could also be designed to be freely resizable, not a 320px app.
Yeah.
So you can sort of preview how your app looks like by just resizing the design time handle.
Nice.
So you can see.
Now, it looks like there's a drop-down in that little tip that showed
up. Absolutely. You can say, okay, I want to preview my app as to how it looks like with 800px. And that's how the app looks like when the actual layout size is 800 pixels and things like that, right? And you can choose amongst...
Oh, very nice. Just to snap to it really quickly.
Exactly.
If you want
to sort of like not worry about like a whole bunch of settings there. You could see how your app looks like when two apps are docked, right? So in this case, you have an app that's on the right-hand side, and there's an app on the left-hand side as well. You could do the same kind of thing. You can sort of resize your app. You can select a bunch of settings and, you know, and so on and so forth.
I apologize you just for a second. If there's not a common question I get, it's this one. Why is my app not able to, why can't I have all the apps side by side like you do on all of your demos? And it's almost always resolution. So what you just showed, two apps side by side and yours in the middle, or two apps on the edge and yours in the middle, that's really going to be based on the resolution of your device and whether or not it supports it.
Absolutely. I mean, it looks a little weird, right? Like, because you just have like a normal, like, but what happens if you have like a really high DPI display? Like, you get more pixels, essentially, more effective pixels, right? That's what we show over here. You can jack this up all the way to a really high value, and that's still a viable platform or a display for your app to be running on.
Yeah.
And you need to make sure that your design is sort of such that it can work against this diverse set of displays that we will see in the near future come out of, you know, of the ecosystem.
Yeah, I think it's just from a practical point of view, it's worthwhile telling developers that you should look at your app like this too, because
that's correct.
You want your app to look great on low-end devices as well as extremely high-end devices too. Especially high-end devices, they're the most likely they're going to buy your app.
Absolutely. The next setting that's important to know about is this thing for high contrast. It's important that your apps are accessible. Yeah. A lot of users have accessibility issues that they want to use your app. You can see your app as it looks like in different accessibility settings. So in this case, I've selected... Just to be clear, like, you cannot control the accessibility setting. The user does it through the Windows control panel. Your app just has to...
Oh, so I can't stop them from doing it.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, you absolutely cannot, and you must, for your app to be certified by a large number of government agencies, your app must be accessible. Mm. And that means, like, you cannot sort of, like, say, okay, I don't really care, and I'm going to hard code all those values. It's in your best interest to be... to build an accessible app as well.
Help me understand. I go into Windows and set my accessibility. How are the values changing to yellow?
That's a system theme brush that automatically gets picked up. So if I was to select the hub section, you can see like the foreground panel already is sort of like it's coming from the style that's applied to the particular text block. Mm-hmm. So if I was to navigate to the text block that sort of is contributing to this look and feel, let's take a look at the style over here. Let me edit the hub section real quick and select this particular text block. You can see like it's picking up the style. So let's say in this case, of course, I don't have. You can see like it's this body text block style.
Yeah.
It's coming from Windows and it's already hooked up to a brush resource that knows how to adapt itself to different high contrast settings.
I see.
So it's one of those.
How could I change that color? Let's pretend that I wish all my text were pink when it's not in high contrast.
Yep.
But I don't want to make it so high contrast doesn't work anymore. Is there a step I should go through to make sure I can have both a custom color and support?
Yeah, you could potentially use theme resources where you could essentially have multiple dictionaries in your app that specify to multiple theme specifications.
Yeah.
So you could have a theme specification for your dark setting of your app or your light setting of your app or for high contrast as well.
And then it's that theme that gets swapped out when it needs to be
That's
high
correct.
Contrast.
And then as long as you kind of maintain consistency of brushes across these multiple themes as far as names are concerned and just continue to use them,
yeah,
you just get that out of the box, right? So that just is...
So if you're setting the color by hand on every text block manually, you're probably doing it wrong because you're at least foregoing this
advantage. It totally depends on the scenario. There are some scenarios where you want to sort of hard code your colors, mm-hmm. but text is primarily a scenario that's really sensitive to high contrast settings and things like that. So you want to be a little careful when you sort of use one of these.
Okay.
You know, in most cases, you can get away with using one of these system-specified text block styles. That way, you get consistency with some of the other Windows apps. Not that that's the only way to do it, but you could do that, and then you could overwrite certain things as you so desired.
Got it.
Then let's take a quick look at some of those other panels as well. Let me switch back to the default thing so I can show the apps settings. So by default, when you create a project template, it's designed to run with the dark theme.
Sure.
But that doesn't mean that's the only theme that's supported.
Kind of a Batman theme.
Exactly. You can switch to the light theme. And when I run this app, you'll notice that the app still is using the light theme, the dark theme, because I've not. This is not a setting That's an OS-specific setting. This is a setting that, the app developer needs to make. So if I go back to Visual Studio real quick.
This is view only.
Yeah, if I go back to Visual Studio, it's an app-wide setting, but you need to set that through the requested theme attribute on the application object. If I set this, I get a couple of values, dark and light. I do not get high contrast because that's not something you can opt into. Okay. That's something that the user opts into via the operating system settings.
Okay.
But certainly you can select between light and dark if you wanted to build, let's say, the mail app. It probably makes sense to have, you know, sort of like white background and dark text versus the other way around, right? So you can certainly do that
as well. Now, you're requesting the theme here at the app level. I think it's from a scope point of view, it's worth mentioning that you can request the theme now in 8.1 at the app level for all of your pages, at the page level, at the stack panel level, anywhere along the tree that you need to now. And that was a really big deal when you would have a dark app, but you would have a light theme settings dialog that popped up. And so you would want, everything wouldn't show up, so you'd have to go and
change. Yeah, in Windows 8.1, there's a property on framework element called requested theme that you can set at any level of the tree, and you can alter the look and feel of that particular level of the tree to be something else, like Jerry says, right? That makes total sense. When you made this change, and if you sort of mouse over this, I don't know why this thing, the focus probably is not working, you should see a tooltip that says, hey, you know what? You made this change. It's not really a good change to make. I mean, I guess I changed this in Visual Studio, but if it did not, you would sort of say, you know, that, hey, you need to make this change in your code as well for it to reflect at runtime.
Got it.
The minimum width setting of your app is sort of like the setting that you would sort of make to sort of opt into a particular scenario, and this sort of plays together with the edge settings, mm-hmm. where your app can only go into a specific size ratio. If you sort of say, hey, I want my app to just,
Right. So if you were back at the edge setting, you were dragging that around, it would stop at 500 unless you selected 320 here. That little warning dialogue is saying, this is fun in the designer, but just know you have to go into your app manifest and really opt into this 320 pixels.
And then finally, we have a couple of settings that allow you to tweak things at design time. So you could choose to show and hide the Chrome.
That's
some people
fun.
Don't like to see, like, you know, the Windows Chrome that we present for the user, so you could do that.
Who are those people? That seems crazy. It's beautiful.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of gets in some cases, it might get in the way of design. So let's say you have content that bleeds over to the left-hand side, and you want to sort of animate the content in as the user
is
launching the app.
Yeah.
They may not want to see the Chrome, so there are use cases for that. But nonetheless, like we see, most people just leave it on.
Mm-hmm.
You can clip to display as well. So if I was to draw a rectangle like somewhere outside here, you can see I can't really see it till I sort of choose to sort of like, you know, so turn on the display setting. Oops, where is my rectangle? Oops, I put it in the wrong place. Let me get out of the content section here. I put the rectangle
over here.
You put
it in the hub section just then because it was currently selected.
Exactly, and I can choose to, you can see like as I'm making this change, I can sort of see like my full rectangle outside the scope of the app as well.
Yeah.
Again, a very useful scenario if you're sort of animating the content in.
Yeah.
You do want to see like things at design time that's outside of your immediate purview of the artboard as well.
Again, all these settings are only here in the designer. They aren't actually affecting your app at runtime.
That's correct. And the device panel that we walked over the last 10 minutes, the same functionality is also available in Visual Studio. So if you wanted to preview your app under different circumstances in Visual Studio, you could certainly use that as well.
The device panel in Blend and Visual Studio are one-to-one, except for this last one in the
panel. The deploy target, right? Is that what you
mean? That's
all.
Yeah.
So in Visual Studio, of course, you would have like the debug the play button, as we call it, to sort of select between like simulator and emulator and things like that, right over here.
Right.
Or even like you can deploy your app to a remote machine mm-hmm. if you're connected via USB. But in Blend, you sort of make that selection via the drop-down over here because we don't have the play button for.
So if you're wondering how do you switch it to simulator while you're in Blend, this is how you do it.
That's correct.
Yeah, no doubt about it. So that's the device panel, probably one of the most core pieces, especially in a design scenario. You're looking at it, it's visually impacting the way that you're making decisions on how you're going to lay out your application.
That's correct.
It's all there. It's also in Visual Studio, so, I mean, they are both there as well, but this is probably an underused feature that I think it's nice to introduce developers to now, no doubt. As far as advanced features, there are a couple things in Visual Studio specifically that I think are at least worth showing at a high level, just so XAML developers know that this is in their toolbox as part of the solution. I think one of them is around performance. We know that performance was improved as far as the framework, improved in the way the controls are built, and improved as best practices that we're giving to developers as well. How does a developer then measure their app to see how well it's doing in performance? that's the diagnostic story.
Yeah, absolutely. And I should correct you by saying, like, some of these are not just optional, some of them are mandatory. For example, the tools to sort of validate your app, you must run them before you submit your app to the store, otherwise you're setting yourself up for disappointment and your app is going to get rejected, right? The default templates are all good in terms of the fact that they pass all these tests, and you can just, like, submit them to the store, though nobody would use them,
I guess, if you don't make
any changes. But
I wonder if there's one in the store.
You certainly, once you start making changes, it's highly recommended that you sort of don't view some of these tools as an afterthought. You kind of build them into your sort of, like, workflow of building the app, so you don't accumulate a lot of debt, be that performance or code quality or anything like that.
If you're finished with your app and suddenly you measure its memory usage or something like that,
exactly,
and you're like, oh, now I have to rewrite the whole app, you're saying do it along step by step by step.
Yes. While we are not going to be going into these tools in any depth, I just want to quickly point them out. In Visual Studio, we have done a lot of work to build analysis tools to sort of figure out issues in your app, and we are just starting in this space. We are investing heavily into building diagnostic tools that help you detect performance issues and correctness issues in your app upfront.
So stay tuned, there's even more to come.
Exactly. So if I was to bring up performance and diagnostics, today I see three tools. Of course, I see the CPU sampling, so if my app is using a lot of my CPU resources, I can figure out why that's the case. I can energy consumption, so...
Wow, so battery impact.
Exactly. Like, there are primarily three main components that go into battery, right? There is the display. If you basically are using the GPU a lot and the display a lot, you kind of use a lot of battery. Network is a primary, battery hog as well. If you're sort of doing a lot of processing over the wire versus locally, right? That's the trade-off you have to make. Like, is it more of the radio that you're using that's sort of causing your app to sort of, you know, consume a lot of the battery? Are you using a lot of the CPU? So you have to make the right trade-off, right, in terms of where you're consuming your energy. And then your responsiveness.
Well, you don't want to make your app annoying to the user, right, as far as, like, every time I run Uni's app, it just kills my battery.
Yeah, exactly. You don't want to also kill the user experience. Like, every time I want to do something, I have to go to the service, which takes a bunch of time. So you have to make the right trade-offs between the user experience and, you know, things like the energy consumption tool help you make that trade-off.
So this third one is really user anger measurement.
That's correct. Like, what's your frame rate? Like, is your app stalling the UI thread? Things like that, right? So let's take a quick look at this tool. You just select the tool, hit start. You get this dialog that says, hey, we're collecting some data about your app.
This is the same app we were in before. No changes?
No changes at all. Like, just click on this page, go back a couple of times, and then go back to Visual Studio real quick and stop collection.
Okay.
So as soon as you do that, Visual Studio is now processing.
So how did you start it? The screen wasn't showing when you started it. How did you invoke that?
You select the tool that you want, and there's a start button. That's the way you would invoke the tool, and we automatically collect ETL data that corresponds to your app, and then we analyze and show you the ETL data. So in this case, we show you a number of things. Yeah. So for example, while this is showing something is bad, it's not necessarily something you can avoid. There's a lot of the app code that is running. Now, of course, you can run your CPU profiling tool and say, hey, you know what, is there a loop that I'm running that's not optimized, or am I doing more work? But you need to do what you need to do to get your business logic up and running.
Right.
You can sort of make your judgment call there. A lot of layout is running here, so can we do something there? Can we sort of, like, replay some of the controls with some simpler versions?
Right.
You know, so
am I loading too many resources that I might be able to load later more dynamically?
I mean, this is a diagnostic tool that gets you some pointers into why these things happen. So in this case, 24.6 milliseconds is spent loading this particular hub section, right? Why is that the case? Like, can you sort of, like, figure out there are 58 elements that are getting constructed?
Wow.
Can you reduce the number of elements to sort of get some performance out and things like that, right?
Yeah.
So you select different sections, figure out why there's an issue. Here's another example of why the hub section is sort of, like, showing up pretty predominantly. A lot of layout is being run that's sort of, like, causing your CPU or UI thread to sort of, like, choke a little bit. So you can make these trade-off decisions by using these tools and sort of make...
Can I use a tool like this to drill into the code that's actually executing as well?
Yes. Combine, like, in Visual Studio 2013 for the current release, you cannot combine these tools, but in the future, we hope to be able to allow you to combine the tools. So the way you do this is you'd use the UI responsiveness tool in combination with the CPU utilization tool.
I see, yeah.
So you'd say, hey, you know what? A lot of this problem is app code. Okay, let's take a look at the CPU tool and figure out what app code is running. Okay, this is app code that I really need to run, or this is bad app code that I could sort of offload for a later point of time or something like that. I could do more async processing. Whatever is the case, you need to make sure that you get really good frame rate on your UI thread so that the app is always responsive. The user never gets the feeling that, you know, the app is stuck to a certain extent. So you could use these tools to make those.
And it is valuable. I mean, XAML has a limit. I mean, you can't just add all the controls that you want. I mean, you need to start thinking as far as complexity of the parsing, complexity of the rendering, and all of the pieces there. So a tool like this is maybe it'll coach a developer to look at their XAML maybe one more time. Maybe there is a way for them to simplify things down, not use as many grids, stack panels nested inside each other. Maybe there's a better way to do it.
Absolutely. So our goal with this tool is to sort of help you point at problem areas and potential, you know, interesting hints about areas that you could go look at and sort of figure out if there is something wrong. Now, it's up to the developer to sort of figure out what the trade-off is between, you know, the leaving the problem there, the user experience, and all of these things, and sort of making the right corrective actions or not, depending upon their scenario.
And sometimes the answer really is, I accept it.
Yes, right? Exactly.
There's a hit there. Yeah. Nothing you can do about it.
I mean, you may want to pay a one-time hit versus a hit through the rest of your app, things like that, right? I mean, in most cases, I think doing things asynchronously and, you know, sort of doing some optimizations does help maintain really beautiful frame rate for Windows Store apps.
Yeah.
So in many cases, like if you look at the best apps in the store, they have pretty good frame rates overall.
Yeah.
Okay.
So these are diagnostics that you use to make your app better,
right?
But they don't play directly to the store. When I go to the store, they have their own, not diagnostics, but they have their own tools to look at my app.
Right. So the way the store integration works is you need to associate, you need to create a developer account in the store.
Okay.
You need to sort of register as a developer and sort of say, hey, I want to sort of start submitting apps. So then you can start collecting telemetry and data and things like that as well. Then when you're ready to publish the app, you need to associate the app with the store.
Okay.
Right. So in this case, the way you do this is you right-click on the app and say, hey, I want to associate my test app with the store. We have a wizard that walks you through the experience, so you go ahead and select, give your live ID.
Nice. So now you're going to reach out to your developer account and find an app that you want to...
Yeah, now in this case, I'm not able to demo this because it's going to take me a while to sort of verify this machine and things
Doesn't
like that.
Doesn't want just anybody using your
app. Yeah, so once you associate your app with the store, you can sort of like then create packages that get uploaded to the store. So in this case, yes, I do want to upload my app to the store, but then I need to go through the workflow. Mm-hmm. So I'm just going to hit no for a second here. And then I can create my app packages, right? So the thing about app packages is you don't want to upload your debug packages to the store. You want to upload your release packages because that's the more performant version of your code. So let's go ahead and select release and hit create. So out of the box, Visual Studio will now sort of like, you know, do the necessary work of, you know, running your the right packaging tools and creating the thing that you just upload to the store with a single click, right? So we do all of that work for you.
Now, the new XAML, but the new way that we deploy apps, XAML apps, is that they are binary XAML when they come down, right? Is that the right word,
that's
binary
correct,
XAML?
Yeah.
And is that occurring right now, or is that is
it
the
happens
store doing
on
that?
All stages? Even if you're building debug and you hit F5, we do that for you. So you always test with that feature on.
Okay.
That's not like an opt-in feature, so to speak.
Yeah.
That's the way you should build apps because that's going to give you performance by default without doing anything.
Not just performance, but a kind of security.
Yeah, it's
with
like
lower
obfuscation
case
a little bit. You know. Yeah, exactly. It's with the lowercase s is a good way of saying that.
Yeah.
So the thing about this workflow is as soon as you create your app packages, the next thing you want to definitely do before you submit your app to the store is run the Windows App Certification Kit. So the Windows App Certification Kit is the set of automated tests. And in a second, you will see the list of tests that we're going to run for you that validate your app thoroughly. Are you using APIs that are not documented by Windows, which is illegal to do? Are you sort of doing the right things as far as configuring your app? We even do things like, you know, if you look at a bunch of the apps in the store, they use the default logos.
Shameful. Yeah,
which is pretty bad, right? You want to sort of have your brand associated with your app as much as you can. So this tool lets you do these kinds of checks as well. Like you can say, okay, you know, manifest test, am I doing branding, right?
Mm-hmm.
So in this case, if I select them all and just use branding validation and hit next, in a second you will see that we're going to fail the test because we're going to, and if I look at the results let's say Internet Explorer, you'll see that, I failed the test because I'm now using logos that are not nothing but the default.
Who does it know that? That's cool.
Because we have
signature
we have worked closely with we as in Visual Studio have worked closely with the team that writes this tool to say, hey, you know what, the default templates in Visual Studio will always use this logo. Make sure that you don't allow an app to be uploaded without the user ever changing these logos.
Nice.
Now, of course, you could go and put a simple pink pixel in there and you would probably pass the test. But the hope is you will sort of...
If you're going that effort to have a bad app,
you might as well get
really
a good logo
it.
Out there.
Yeah,
you know, so.
Exactly.
So the Windows certification
now, the WAC,
kit...
So I say WAC, but that's what we call it too, the Windows Application Certification Kit, WACK. What's important about it is this is the exact tooling that the store is using as well. So if you're not wanting to be surprised by the store...
That's right. I mean, the store does a little bit more that cannot be automated.
Of course, yeah.
Like, for example, like we can't automate if you have a valid privacy policy setting, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's on some site. That site might be down on a particular day. So that's things that the store can sort of catch as well. But this certainly gets to a good percentage of the issues that you potentially could get dinged on, like if you sort of like just upload to the store without doing anything.
Yeah.
So we highly recommend that you don't sort of submit an app without sort of passing it through.
If there are 20 or 30 tests that's in the WAC, probably 99% of them, if you fail just one, it's going to come back to you from the store. You're going to need to correct that before you submit it again. So it's the right thing. Sometimes it takes a while to run all those tests, but it's worth it because it's going to save you a round trip.
And it's automated. By the way, you can run these certification tools on a remote machine as well. We are doing things like measuring the responsiveness time of your app. You will probably not get the right measurement on your, you know, powerful dev machine as you would get on an ARM tablet or something like that. You know, so you want to make sure that you're running these tests not just local to your machine, but also on the target device that the user... It's about the consumer experience at the end of the day. The app needs to start up quickly, right?
Yeah.
Like otherwise the consumer is going to sort of not use your app at some point. So it's highly recommended that you do take the time to run these tests, not on your machine, but on the
at least right before you submit, just so you don't get too
surprised. We prefer if you sort of build these practices along the dev cycle,
and not just do it at the very end, you can do it, or something like that.
Whatever fits your sort of
and the fact that I can do it on a remote machine, that means I don't have to stop developing. Yeah. I can go ahead and do that and have it part of my workflow.
Certainly, if you're going agile, every sprint.
You can do it every sprint if I want, right? Every check-in, it needs to be. There are other advanced features. One of them that we won't cover is automated UI testing. Mm-hmm. That's the ability to create a test project that goes and actually does all of the clicking and validates the values that we might have in form fields or in some of the controls that are there as well. Another neat feature inside Visual Studio that's now tooled for XAML developers as well. All right, I think we should take a break.
Yep.
We'll come back to Module 3 in 10 minutes. And so we'll see everybody in 10 minutes.
And we'll promise you guys a lot of blend action going forward.
It'll be all blend from this point forward, yeah? See ya.